Welcome to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. In the wake of a pretty contentious election, here's a crucial question. Are we a hopelessly divided country, just red states and blue states, followers of either Sean Hannity or Rachel Maddow, just plain irreconcilable? Well, who better to ask than two professors at the cutting edge of studying how people think? How did we end up so polarized? And how, fairly easily, might we be able to chip away at some of that polarization? Steve Sloman is a professor of cognitive, linguistic, and psychological sciences at Brown University and co-author of the recent New York Times op-ed, I'm Right, for some reason, which we're going to link to on our website. Steve Sloman, thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Todd Rogers is an assistant professor of public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School. Todd Rogers, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
So, Steve Sloman, let me throw it to you first. In the work that you've done, is your sense that the political divide is really very facts-based, or is it more reflex-based?
Well, I certainly believe that it's reflex-based. I think the problem is that we don't worry enough about what the facts are. What we have shown in conjunction with some of our colleagues, Silfern back at Colorado and Craig Fox at UCLA, is that people in the political domain suffer from what's called the illusion of explanatory depth, which is that they think they understand things that they just don't. And we believe that this is one of the sources of the contentiousness in our political world. When we think we understand things, it seems to lead us to take strong, intransigent positions. But fortunately, what we know is that it's easy to break people of that feeling.
So I want to get to how you break that down in a minute, but why are we so quick to say, yes, I believe this, and I believe it fervently with all my heart, even if we don't really understand the policy we believe?
Well, so what we've shown is that we think we understand. So I think the problem may be that when we don't understand, we believe we do. And the reason I say that is that it turns out, we know from work by Frank Kyle and his students at Yale, that even for simple objects like toilets and pens, people have a sense of understanding that when you probe them, turns out to be wrong. They don't understand things nearly as well as they think they do. And so I actually think that it's that inflated sense of understanding that's one of the sources that leads to a strong sense of rightness about issues.
So if you do want to then break that down, if you want to sort of break people apart from, I really believe strongly in issue A, and here's why, how do you get people to stop being quite so passionate and to understand that they don't maybe actually understand the issue all that well?
So the key is to not ask the question you just asked, which is, why do you believe in it, right? If you ask people that question, then that makes them more intransigent. What you have to ask them is, why is it that you believe this policy is going to lead to the things that you want? So you have to ask people to unpack the causal mechanism that underlies the policy that you're talking about. So if you're talking about something like sanctions on Iran, then you say to them, you know, what is it you hope to gain from sanctions on Iran? And how exactly do you think sanctions are going to lead to these policies or these goals that you desire? And what we find is that when we ask people those questions, it turns out they have much less to say than they think they do. And that's what leads them to rate their own understanding as less. And in turn, they then become more open and less extreme on the issue.
So if you have somebody who comes into the experiment saying, I definitely believe we should impose sanctions on Iran, and then you start to ask them, well, how do you think that that will help to punish Iran? Or, you know, you start to ask them the causal relationship there. Give us a little insight into the experiment. What kinds of things do people start to say when they start to try to explain something to you?
Well, mostly they just say nothing, or they repeat what it is that they hope to gain, or they just restate the problem that you have started with. In other words, people really don't understand mechanisms to the degree that they think they do. And so when you ask them for the mechanism, they just have incredibly little available to them to report. And it's that lack of knowledge that punctures this illusion that they have that they understand and makes them more open.
And how do you know that at that point they're more open? I mean, do you try to then maybe convince them that it doesn't make that much sense to impose sanctions on Iran?
That's a good idea, and that's something we want to do. So far, all we've done is to ask them how they feel about the issue before they try to explain it and how they feel about the issue after they try to explain it. And it turns out that they're less extreme after than they are before. And we've also compared different groups that tell us how extremely they feel about it beforehand, and a different group that explains it and then gives us a rating of their attitude afterwards. And they just feel less extreme after they've tried to explain it and discovered that they can't. Not only that, but they're less willing to give money to an advocacy group in favor of their prior position after they've tried to explain the issue.
Interesting. Todd Rogers from the Kennedy School. When you think back to the 2012 election, which is very recently in the rearview mirror, are there some issues that jump out at you as being the kind of issues that Steve Sloman talks about? Probably issues that people had very little depth of understanding on, but they felt very strongly about.
Sure. I think a lot of the issues that the candidates talk about are complex in a way that people don't appreciate. And I think that's the amazing part. So how will cutting taxes on the wealthy and maybe even cutting taxes on everyone lead to 12 million jobs being created? There are at least 15, 20, 100, I have no idea because I don't know the mechanisms, different pathways through which this policy, this proposed policy change that, for example, Romney would put out would lead to the kinds of job outcomes that he claims. So I think the campaign was interesting on this front, but I think we're entering into an even much more interesting, rich, and frankly, scary period where there are incredibly important issues that have to be resolved. The fiscal cliff is just the most immediate of them. But there are lots of long-term issues that have to be resolved in the next presidency. And if we thought that the virtual rioting during the summer of 2009, as the Tea Party revolted against Obamacare during town hall meetings, was bad, we're going to enter a period where there is going to be massive extremist partisan debate about issues that no one really understands. And so this finding that Steve was describing and that this team that it's been a real pleasure to work with on this project, this whole problem of polarization and extremism being supported and exacerbated by the illusion of explanatory depth is an even bigger problem moving forward. Just even think about the degree to which we cut spending to increase GDP growth or we increase taxes to balance the deficit. Like any of these, people make causal claims and the mechanisms are unbelievably complex. Our research would suggest that asking people to explain the causal process and how it leads to the outcome that people are advocating for would moderate people, would make people less extreme in their views.
It's interesting because, you know, we talk so much about the fiscal cliff and should, you know, spending cuts to revenue increases be 5-1, 10-1. But is your sense that people have any idea of what those things mean, 5-1, 2-1, 10-1? I wonder if even the politicians who cite those ratios know what they mean.
Well, one of the issues is who's responsible for knowing what they mean. And this is something that even the four of us debate, but you could argue that it's not the duty of a citizen to understand fully every issue that's out there. But presumably it is the responsibility of our politicians, right? So those people who are getting up on the stump and making strong claims about what the beneficial effects of this or that tax cut would be really have to understand and be able to explain exactly how that tax cut is going to lead to the promised benefits.
Now, that would be fascinating if we could get a sample of electeds who are advocating for a position, and even if we don't show extremism, but we show that they don't even understand the causal mechanisms, that would be fascinating. And it's got to be true.
Yeah. No, I think it's got to be true, too. And I'll add to that that it strikes me that it's the responsibility of the media to make that clearer to the electorate, to probe and to push politicians to explain how it is that their policies are going to lead to effects. Because I do believe that you don't have to necessarily ask someone to spell out their own understanding of a mechanism. In the work on simple objects that Frank Kyle has done, what he has shown is that giving somebody an explanation is also sufficient to reduce their sense of understanding. And so presumably that would also open people up and moderate their opinions, right? Providing an explanation rather than having them generate one.
I'm Kara Miller, and this is Innovation Hub, and we're talking with Steve Sloman from Brown and Todd Rogers from Harvard's Kennedy School about new research into why we're so polarized and how we might be able to break down some of that polarization. And Steve Sloman, you sparked our conversation with your op-ed in the New York Times, which listeners can link to at our website, wgbh.org/innovationhub. And you say in the piece that there are phrases that politicians throw around, but it can be really hard to figure out what they actually mean. So, for example, let's stand up to China, or let's have a flat tax. And these are statements that people might have this visceral reaction to, positive or negative, but they may not actually be sure what the statement implies, what it would really mean for their lives to say, stand up to China.
Right. So more specifically, what we show is that we don't know, for instance, what starting a trade war with China, what consequences that would have, right? The idea really is that we don't understand mechanisms. So we often understand facts. We know what it means to have a flat tax. What we don't understand are the implications of having a flat tax, right? They're also, as Todd was saying, the economy is an incredibly complex system, and it would have all sorts of ripple effects in a million places to have a flat tax. And those are the things that really matter. Those are the things that are going to determine the state of this country. And yet, those are the things we have very little idea about. And to be frank, it seems to me those are the things that we don't discuss in our political discourse. Those issues were not debated during any of the debates, in part because they're so incredibly complicated.
Now, Todd Rogers, I know you have worked a lot with politicians and politically oriented groups. And for politicians to say things like, let's stand up to China, there's a clear motivation for that. They know it's going to affect people.
Right. I mean, they're appealing to and probably in the process reinforcing this illusion of understanding that people have, right? When they say, we need to stand up to China because they're bullying us or manipulating the trade deficit, they're just playing into people's beliefs that they understand how all that works, and we're going to sort of align ourselves by partisan differences. I do think that this sort of takeaway and the drive home from this research is that as we are, especially in the moments we're about to enter, as we are debating and discussing incredibly consequential and contentious issues, it's not that the outcome is going to change by making people aware of their own lack of understanding, but it's just that people should be less extreme. That's the big takeaway, is that people can make themselves less extreme by just coming to understand how little they understand about the given issue they're talking about. Politicians probably leverage it and take advantage of it for partisan advantage. But now that we are out of the campaign and we are now into a critical legislative period, I mean, I think this is even more important than it was during the campaigns.
Let me play a little clip of an ad that we heard during the campaign. This is an Obama ad, but it plays on something that Mitt Romney had talked about during the campaign, the issue of cutting funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Let's listen to it.
The evil genius who towered over them, one man has the guts to speak his name.
Big Bird. Big Bird. Big Bird.
It's me, Big Bird.
Big, yellow, a menace to our economy. Mitt Romney knows it's not Wall Street you have to worry about. It's Sesame Street.
I'm going to stop the subsidy to PBS.
Mitt Romney, taking on our enemies no matter where they nest.
Todd Rogers from Harvard. You know, we got into this discussion about Big Bird in the campaign, but I wonder, when you think about how much voters understood about how much PBS or NPR takes of their money, do you think there was any real discussion of numbers or impact?
I think there is good research on this that polling organizations have shown that people have absolutely no idea how the federal budget is allocated. And it is my understanding that PBS is something like 1/100 of 1% of the federal budget,
right,
or probably even less than that. And most people would estimate that it is probably 100 or 1,000 times more than that. Yeah, there's no sense of proportion. You know, they would go from talking about letting the Bush tax cuts expire to cutting PBS. And we're literally talking about maybe a 10,000-fold difference in impact on the federal budget. But frankly, in that situation, what Romney was doing was he was trying to signal a willingness to cut, and he was also trying to prevent cutting anything that was going to have a constituency that would revolt. And sort of that's consistent with the way he campaigned. Like, whenever he would be specific, he would be specific about something uncontroversial and relatively less consequential, because the consequential stuff has people on both sides of it.
But Steve Solomon, it's interesting because, given what Todd Rogers said, you would think that the Obama campaign would have come back with, well, look, let's look at the data. You know, PBS and NPR, they don't actually take up very much money, so we could cut them or not cut them, but it's not going to do that much. But that's not what they came back with. They came back with this kind of ad, which is much more of a tugging at the heartstrings kind of thing rather than data-driven analysis. So is there a reluctance from politicians to get into the stuff you're talking about, which is, okay, what's the data here? How does it work?
Right. Absolutely, there's a reluctance. And, and I think it's important to acknowledge that there should be a reluctance, right? Because people don't understand complicated systems. I mean, by definition, that's what it means to be complicated. And so trying to get into the intricacies of the budget and have this tax or that cut is going to change things for the average citizen is in a sense, not going to get anywhere. So I actually don't think the issue that we're talking about, the illusion of explanatory depth, really should play out on the stage of political advertising, right? I think the question is, do these candidates really know what they're talking about such that in the right forum they can answer the question in detail? Are they being probed by the media? And are the answers available even if they're not part of their day-to-day advertising campaign? And the other half of it isn't so much that every citizen has to understand every issue in all its gory depth. You can't. The world is too complex. Right. The issue for me is simply how humble we should be about the extent to which we do understand things. And if we were more humble, then perhaps we would be more open to having a civil discourse.
You know, it's interesting because we're sort of entering into the time of year when people see people in their family who may not agree with them. And I wonder, how do you take the information that you get from the lab and apply it to a situation where people are interacting? They do not agree ideologically with what other people are saying. How do you, in a conversational setting, start to break down those barriers and maybe see that there is some sort of moderate ground on which there could be agreement?
I think that's a great question, and I don't think it's easy. But what you have to do is essentially ask people that you're conversing with in the nicest way possible to explain what they mean, right? So if they claim that the rich should be taxed more than they are, then you have to ask them to explain what precisely the effect of that would be and what its downstream consequences would be. And through that, people would discover that there are gaps in their knowledge. And when there are gaps in one's knowledge and one's aware that there are gaps, then one's more open to filling those gaps. And I think it would just make conversation a more constructive process, in part by reducing some of those gaps. We could share our knowledge to some degree.
And Todd Rogers from the Kennedy School, what's your sense of how you find that middle ground between, very polarized states, very often very polarized families in this country.
I think Steve's point is worth underscoring. Steve is saying that our research can speak to extremism in the American electorate and also can improve Thanksgiving dinner, which is instead of yelling, "Uncle Tommy, you have no idea what you're talking about," which I'm sure I'm not the only one who has yelled at different points, maybe saying, "You know, Uncle Tommy, let's figure out how this would work," and then trying to actually turn it into a constructive discussion about the mechanism rather than the outcome, which is so, you know, we want America to be strong. We want the federal government to not go bankrupt. So how would cutting these taxes or increasing these taxes or cutting this program or that program, how do we think that would work? And I think even though I am moderately informed on some issues, even I, who have pretty strong preferences, could probably enter into a civil discussion with Uncle Tommy on that.
And it's interesting, in this very polarized country, I wonder if people are being affected by social media. Because now during a debate or as you're watching political coverage on TV, you can be engaged with many screens at the same time, streams of information coming at you.
Right. It's fascinating, and it has pros and cons. So on the pros, I have seen and I keep hearing about people who are watching political activities and concurrently are investigating things that either don't sound right or things that sound interesting. And so in that way, this sort of two screens allows them to dive deep on the things that they are interested in diving deep on. At the same time, it probably distracts them so that they have an even more cursory exposure to what is actually going on while they're watching the debates or listening to the campaigns.
So they're partially relying on their sense of the candidate or the idea that they came in to the speech with.
I guess, yes. But I mean, it goes both ways. One is that you can dive deep into things you're interested in, but at the same time, it distracts you from hearing things that either you didn't want to hear or things that the campaigns or the media thinks that you should hear.
Steve Slobin, what's your sense of what's happening?
Well, I think there are multiple contributions to partisanship in our society. And what concerns me about social media is the extent to which people can surround themselves by like-minded folk, right? It's the fact that we have a tendency to expose ourselves only to those people who believe what we already believe that creates a lot of problems. I mean, I think it leads to the obvious problem that we don't see points of view that we don't agree with and therefore don't see arguments for those points of view. But it also, I think, makes our conversation a little more superficial, because when you're surrounded by people you agree with, there's much less need to justify. And the way you justify is by explaining the mechanism by which the policy you're talking about is going to lead to desired benefits.
Have you seen a real effect from the kind of polarization of the media I mentioned in the beginning, the idea that, you know, Sean Hannity is your person or Rachel Maddow is your person, and you've chosen up sides? Do you see an effect there when you do experiments on the way that people think about their ideology?
Well, we certainly see an effect in the sense that, you know, people are going to express an opinion that's consistent with where they fall on the liberal-conservative divide. But actually what we don't find is that liberals and conservatives differ in their responsiveness to our intervention, right? So our intervention is simply asking them to explain what they mean. And both liberals and conservatives are affected by that. Both of them moderate their opinion when they discover that they can't explain what you've asked them.
There's a great article that summarizes some of your work in Discover magazine, and there's a quote from it that talks about Adlai Stevenson, who in the middle of the 20th century was standing on a stage and a supporter shouts out during one of his campaigns, "You've got the vote of every thinking person." And Adlai Stevenson says back, "That's not enough, madam. We need a majority." And I wonder, Steve
right.
Slobin, do you worry that the Sean Hannitys and Rachel Maddows have allowed us to turn off our thinking because they do our thinking for us?
No, I don't worry about that. I mean, let me say a couple things. First of all, I'm not sure I'd put Sean Hannity and Rachel Maddow in exactly the same box in that regard. We have done some work on what's called the cognitive reflection test, which is a measure essentially of people's willingness to deliberate, how much they like explaining things. And there's a certain proportion of the population that really does like explaining things. And in fact, they're probably going to be less influenced by our manipulations than the rest of the population because they're going to generate the causal explanation even before we ask them to. But the fact is that that's a minority of the population, and the data we have suggests that the population that doesn't particularly enjoy deliberation or at least doesn't engage in it isn't going to engage in it no matter what. You know, whether Sean Hannity does their thinking for them or not, they're just not going to think through issues. They're going to reason and decide on some other basis.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned this cognitive reflection test, and since most people don't know much about it, I'm going to give an example of a question so people can see what they would say from the CRT, the cognitive reflection test, and then I'll throw it to Todd Rogers. So here's the question. A bat and a ball cost $1.10 in total, and the bat costs $1 more than the ball. How much does the ball cost? So your inclination would be to say 10 cents, but the answer is $1.05 and 5 cents. The ball costs 5 cents and the bat costs $1.05, and you add them together and it's $1.10. And interestingly, it seems like the people who did really well on the CRT, and correct me if I'm wrong here, were willing to think and rethink and recheck their answer before they said, okay, this is it, this is my answer.
Exactly. That's exactly the idea. And what's amazing about this question is that the guy who developed the cognitive reflection test, a guy named Shane Frederick, has shown, along with a number of other people, that it's incredibly predictive of a vast number of things. My favorite example, one of Shane's, is that it predicts whether people like dark versus milk chocolate. So tell me, Kara, who do you think prefers dark chocolate? People who do well on the CRT or people who do poorly?
Oh, gee. I mean, I really like them both, but now I'm worried to reveal what I really like.
I see. Well, your listeners know that it's the high CRT, the people who get the answer right, that like dark chocolate.
Okay, okay. Todd Rogers, is your sense that it is really a minority of people that are willing to do this really reflective cognitive reasoning?
Well, first, I am glad to hear that it is dark chocolate, people. The point is, so CRT, this cognitive reflection test, identifies people's propensity to think deeply about problems and their deliberation and a wide range of topics. And basically, it's a cognitive tendency. And I'm not sure we're going to change people as humans as they go through their life to make them more cognitively reflective. But people are as they are, and they can change. But I'm not sure that our agenda or objective here is to change them on this. But it's more to make people aware that as they think deeply about the mechanisms of a problem, they come to realize that they don't understand it as well as they thought. And a nice downstream consequence of that is that it's just hard to justify being extreme on something that you don't understand. And so maybe high CRT people, and I'm not even sure, Steve, if we've looked at this, I presume you have because you've done a lot with CRT, but I bet high CRT people are less likely to not understand things that they think they understand. So they are less vulnerable to this illusion of understanding. Is that
we,
right?
We have, in fact, shown that not with the political questions, but with other kinds of questions. That's true.
Right. So that makes sense. Even high CRT people probably fall prey to it in some domains, but the challenge and the charge is maybe when you realize that you're holding an extreme view, check yourself and see if you understand how this policy would actually work or if it's just a miscalibration of your own understanding.
Todd Rogers, when you work either with politicians or when you think about the politics we've seen, I wonder if you ever worry about the kind of issues that feel black and white. So should we have tax cuts on the rich, or should we allow abortion, or shouldn't we? with those kinds of issues, is there any space for this kind of discussion and moderation, or are they simply, no, it's a black or white issue, no room for moderation?
That's a great question. I don't know that we have explored that, but I have an intuition. My hypothesis would be that certainly those more values-based policies are probably less prone to this problem. That said, we can sort of sidestep this issue because the most important issues facing us over the next year, at least, and probably over the next decade, are actually going to be substantive policy issues about where we cut and where we generate revenue. Of course, we're going to continue to have abortion, gay marriage, and other sort of social issues, but the policy debates that will be going on in Washington, certainly over the next couple of years, are going to be focused on things that are purely mechanistic, that I think there may be dogma and like ideological commitment to cutting taxes or not, but all of it is tied to a belief that it leads to some outcome, which means that there is a mechanistic pathway from the policy to the outcome that I think both parties probably share the same objectives with regards to the ultimate outcomes.
Steve Solomon, what's your sense of absolute polarizing issues? Are they absolute issues with no middle ground, essentially?
I'll reiterate what Todd said. I mean, again, we haven't done any research on this, but I do think it's really important to distinguish values-based issues from issues that causal understanding is relevant to. So if you take an issue like abortion, I doubt somehow we would get our effects because I don't think people's views on that issue are determined by their understanding of the consequences of having one policy or another with respect to abortion. I think to a large extent, they're based on their fundamental values about life. And so asking for a causal explanation is sort of beside the point. But that's one perhaps small subset of issues that are facing us. And the big ones, the important ones that we're having to debate in the near future, as Todd says, those really are up for grabs. Those really are consequentialist, right, in the sense that the value of the policy is determined solely by its ability to deliver the effects that we're looking for.
Todd Rogers, how is behavioral science changing politics itself? We're talking about how it can change maybe regular people out there who are consuming politics, but is it changing politics, politicians, how they do things?
So there's a lot of ways to tackle that. One way to think about it is, how is behavioral science affecting the way campaigns are run,
right,
and the way campaigns are conducted? And that would be another 2-hour-long episode of your show. But in short, behavioral science over the last 5 to 10 years has had a profound impact on the way field operations are run in campaigns. And I should say that I think of behavioral science as two things. One is a set of insights about how humans behave and think. And the second is a set of tools for isolating causal relationships. And I think that the second one is underappreciated and underdiscussed, which is that the human mental apparatus is terrible at making causal inferences when treatments lead to real but small effects. So it turns out that when you make a phone call to encourage someone to vote, you have about somewhere between a 1 and 3 percentage point effect on increasing their likelihood of voting. Right? It's small but consistent and real and important. But there's no way you could possibly detect that just by calling people and just seeing if they vote or not. And so by doing randomized controlled experiments, we're able to assess the specific contribution of different tactics and then bringing to that the insights about human behavior, we're able to develop best practices and tools for making campaign activities more effective that leverage what we know about how humans behave and what motivates humans.
And I know you've looked at the peer pressure effect of if somebody actually shows up at your house and says, you know, it would be great if you got out and vote, doesn't that have even more of an effect than calling them up on the phone?
Sure. So Alan Gerber and Don Green, Alan is at Yale and Don is at Columbia, they have been doing these experiments since 1998 where they randomly assign people to receive either a phone call or a door knock or a piece of mail or something else. And consistently what they would find is that the more personal, the more effective, which is the more it's a human interacting with a human, the more powerful it is. As of about 2005 onward, we started bringing psychological insights to it, the kinds that Steve and I have been talking about and that this whole field of behavioral science focuses on, about sort of systematic patterns of thinking and behavior that help us understand humans, trying to bring that to bear on how do we make these activities more effective. And so specifically, an example is encouraging people to vote. Nearly everybody says they intend to vote when you ask them, but, you know, only half to two-thirds vote depending on the election. And so what we found in an experiment, David Nickerson, a professor at Notre Dame, and I found that asking people to make a plan, what time will you vote, how will you get there, where will you be coming from, just this battery of plan-making questions, which is borrowed from cognitive psychology, that if you have people think through the implementation steps, they're more likely to follow through, that more than doubles the impact of the phone call. And so that has become widely used. And I will make an observation. I've seen the Get Out the Vote scripts used by the Obama campaign, and I've seen the Get Out the Vote scripts used by the Romney campaign. And it is astonishing to me that despite this research being published, the Romney campaign's Get Out the Vote scripts did not reflect all the behavioral science that is published on how to increase turnout. I have no way of explaining it. I don't understand it. And the Obama campaign scripts reflect the science, which one might expect.
What did the Obama script say that the Romney script seemed to be missing?
So they always ask people to make a plan. What time will you vote? How will you get there? Where will you be coming from? And they almost always began with a very, like, helpful prompt. Research shows that people find it helpful to make a plan. And then in other research that I conducted with Alan Gerber, we found that emphasizing high turnout, lots of people will be voting versus not enough people will be voting. Emphasizing high turnout motivates people. And so given that this was a very high turnout election, the scripts sensibly emphasized and highlighted that turnout is going to be very high. Join the rest of your citizens.
Interesting. The power, as we all know, as we've experienced since we were little kids, of peer pressure. Well, everybody else is going to be doing it. Don't you want to be a part of this? And I have one final question for you, Steve Sloman. It's something that I wonder about a lot, and we talk so much and we lament this notion that we're a very polarized country and this is terrible. But you look at the brain, and I wonder if there is something intrinsic about people that we tend to put ourselves in tribes. We tend to separate ourselves in camps. And I wonder, is it to you surprising that we're a polarized country?
It's not surprising to me that we are tribal in that way. That's a good point. What's surprising to me is how hard it is for us to have a civil conversation. And one thing that we haven't referred to is one condition, half of our experiment, which showed that if you, instead of asking people to generate a causal explanation, if you say to them, why do you think what you think? What we found is that that doesn't moderate them, doesn't moderate people. And in other experiments, people have found that that actually makes people more extreme. So, for instance, if you ask people what their attitudes are and then put them in a group, particularly a group of like-minded people, and have them discuss the issue, they'll come out of that group discussion more polarized. They'll come out of that group discussion believing what they believed before to a more extreme degree. So I think it is the case that when you hang around with people who see things the way you do, the nature of the discourse is to find reasons for believing what you do, not for considering why you might consider the opposite perspective.
Very interesting. So when we see those results on election night and we think, wow, how did that state get so deep red, whereas that state is so darn blue?
Right.
It's the peer pressure effect again, a little bit.
Right. Perhaps. Yeah, that's a good point.
We've been talking about how we think and why we think the way we do, and I've been speaking with Todd Rogers, an assistant professor of public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School, and Steve Sloman, a professor of cognitive, linguistic, and psychological sciences at Brown. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining us. Great discussion.
Thank you very much, Cara.
Yeah, thank you. This has been fun.
And thank you for joining us. Remember that you can subscribe to our free podcast or link to Steve Sloman's recent op-ed in the New York Times on our website, wgbh.org/innovationhub. And coming up next, Microsoft's former head of technology tells us about his new nuclear venture and why he worries that solar and wind power may just not cut it.
Because your total energy usage and mine is, on average, about the equivalent of having 10 toasters running 7 by 24. Well, in China, the average is about 2.5 toasters. Well, China is developing, so they're going to be building about a factor of 5 more power, because ultimately they're going to get up to our level of power.
I'm Kara Miller, and this is Innovation Hub.
Welcome to a new kind of tension. All across the alien nation.